Hey, welcome to Life 2.0 Podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from anywhere and everywhere around planet Earth. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Hold on to your friggin' lug nuts, kids. Time for an overall. Joining me one more time. I'm kind of chuckling on the intro there because this is my second take at the introduction. Just full disclosure here, right? You know, by the time I've done thousands and thousands and thousands of shows, they don't all come out the way I think they should. So a little cut and paste and editing here and there, trimming, you know, slap and dump, you're good to go. So I was sitting here and even further full disclosure, I've been up, I don't know when you're going to be hearing this. It's at 6:20 in the morning in Chicago. Glorious morning. Sun's starting to come up. It's going to be a beautiful day here. And I've been up for a while. And in keeping with my thought process of not turning on this microphone just to, you know, speculate, bloviate, and verbally expectorate, I was thinking about what is it on my mind and what is it, you know, that I want to kind of share this morning. And got everything pulled together. Oh, here's what it is. Got it. Okay, good. And I started the show, but I forgot to do the introduction. So I had to hear taking care of business twice, which is a good thing in my world. So anyway, glad to have you joining me. As I mentioned, it's beautiful here today. The sun is coming up. It's going to be 80 degrees. Summer is knocking on the door, and that means I won't be wearing shoes outside for much longer. So that's a good thing. A little bit of ground to cover today. As April is ending, we're heading into May. And of course, April has become Earth Month. It started out as Earth Day, and then it was Earth Week, and then now it's Earth Month, and I think that's progress, and it's a good thing. There's a growing awareness over the decades I've been doing this work that people are far more connected, I think, to what's going on in the natural world than ever before. I think there's a lot of factors for that. I think programming is important. I think the things that Bill Curtis and I did for years and still continue to do, the Earth Matters series, has been vitally important getting the word out to people. There's just a different sense of sensibility. And I think that is good. I think it's very good. You know, I had at least 10, 12 emails, text messages, and assorted other fodder come in after I made the comments last week on the show about the one thing you can do, the one thing you can do to make a huge difference. And this is really clear here, kids. This is not about saving the planet. There's all those bumper stickers and t-shirts I call bullshit. This isn't about, the planet could care less. You know, there's no sense of a hierarchy here on the planet. We just happen to be a species that have become pretty adept at taking a shit in our own bed sometimes and ignoring it. And eventually that stuff catches up to you. So the whole show I did last week about talking, you know, with Cuyahoga River and my dad putting oil in the sewers and all that kind of stuff and all the different changes that were made, culminating in the fact that the one thing you can do, because it can be overwhelming, is to stop buying bottled water. It's just one, just that is huge, 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 huge. And I got all this kind of incoming about people who did just that or committed to do that. My job's done. I'm good. I mean, there's times you may have to do that, but I'm talking about this whole going out to the store and buying cases of bottled water. You know, I'm just going to try and not get on that stump too much because I beat it in the ground last week, but it bears repeating. There's nothing good comes out of that. Most bottles don't get recycled. You drink the water, which you can get from a filter on your sink if you need to have that, if you're worried about it. You can get the Brita pitcher. You put it in there. It goes in. You put it in the fridge. You got nice fresh water. And it's reusable over and over again. And then the filter, of course, does have to get discarded, but it's not far less intrusive and invasive than billions of bottles. So thanks for the response for all that and taking that initiative and doing those type of things. Because I would search for years. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but one of the first talks that I ever gave, and I've done hundreds around the world, literally, on a very, you know, various subjects. And the environment, of course, has always been something that's been kind of the foundational piece of the work that I do. And I remember being at this first talk I gave, and I gave out 50 things you could do today to make a difference. I mean, here's what you do here, because here's what happens. All you do is you hear this bad news about how shitty things are, and if you poke at people constantly, apathy sets in. It truly does. I mean, and it's kind of like a response thing, you know? It's like the world seems to be a shitbox sometimes, but it's not. It's only a keyhole that the news is looking through. I've been in the business. I used to turn the news off while I was sitting in the studio at WGN. I couldn't take it anymore. These guys right above me, this next floor up, you know, another murder happened today in the traffic. And it's like over and over and over. And while those things are true and they're horrible, there's not a friggin' thing I can do about it except get pissed off. And life's too short for that, in my humble opinion. So I'm doing this talk. I have these 50 things, and they're all sorts of stuff. Just do something. Because when you take action in a direction of something of concern, all of a sudden you have less time to complain about what's going on, less time to focus on what's not working. You're actually taking some sort of positive, concrete, constructive action in a direction to change that. That's empowering, as opposed to sitting in the corner going, oh my God, what, the world's coming to an end. I guarantee you that every previous generation said the same thing. How could you bring a child into the world during World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam? The list goes on and on. And yet we're still here. We're still chopping away at it. We're still trying to make the best of it. I think so. And so the stuff we get on the news is just a small, tiny particle of what's really going on in the world. And when it comes to the environmental challenges we all face, I don't care if you like it or not, believe it or not, give a shit or not. Eventually, at some point, as I made the point last week, we live in a biosphere. Everything stays here. It doesn't go anywhere else. One of the first Earth Matters that I ever produced with Bill Curtis was about water. And get this, and you must know this. If you don't, then you missed this in fifth grade. We do not get any new water on this planet. Attention, please. We get no more new water. This is it. The water that we use today is the same water that the brontosaurus was walking around in the swamps in the Jurassic period. Zip, end of story. It goes up, it comes down. It goes up, it comes down. The atmosphere takes care of all that. And the aquifers that this stuff all gets filtered through are essential to the lifeblood of this planet. So as we continue to take more water than we need, we got to figure out ways to work around that, like desalination. Now, how do we start grabbing the ocean water, you know, to make plastic bottles and fill them with water? In my humble opinion, it's a ridiculous cycle. So unless you're living in like some desert somewhere and you got to dig in the ground to get well water, just get a filter. Get a Brita. I should really have them as a sponsor. They're not. I'm just saying that's what we use. If there's any thought about the water isn't where you think it should be where you live, there's ways to do it. Just don't go to the store and buy scads and pallets full of plastic bottles. Give it a rest already. There, I'm done with that. Anyway, I want to give a short shout out to my friend Bill Curtis. I talked to him last week about all of this. And he said, I wish I could do his impersonation. I don't do a very good Bill Curtis. A lot of people do. And of course, he's the great voice from A&E, Cold Case Files, American Justice. You know it. He's done it. But I talked with him and he got on the phone. He says, you know, John, you know, we've been working on this 10 years and maybe just now it's starting to take effect. Like you need to hear this stuff for 10 years before people go, huh, you mean there's another option? Yeah, there's another option. Anyway, Earth Matters this morning with Bill Curtis.
There are billions of trees on planet Earth, from the smallest seedling to the mighty redwood. But is it possible they are all connected? We tend to take trees for granted. They are truly the lungs of the earth, cleaning the very air we breathe. But now comes an incredible theory from the forests of Germany. Trees have their own social network and can talk or communicate with each other, says forest ranger Peter Wallenben, who has spent decades in the forest and is the author of The Hidden Life of Trees. He also has concluded that trees reach out for one another and oftentimes get so interconnected at the root system that when one tree dies, so do the others it's connected to. He insists that trees are far more than just a resource for lumber. They are truly friends in the forest, and if we listen close enough, perhaps we can hear their voices. For Earth Matters, I'm Bill Curtis.
One of the great gifts that I've had in my life when I lived in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and they were really a central piece of my life there, are my Native American friends, the Ojibwa. And every now and again, I will sit here while I'm doing something else and just kind of wander off and look in the yard here of all the trees that we have. And I think of my friends and how much I learn from them that I was not taught in traditional education, how they are connected to the earth in ways that I never would have even considered. And there's been a lot of really influential people in my life that live up there and still live up there. And I'm not as in touch with them as I used to be as often. When I go up, I see them, of course, we spend time together. But for almost 20 years, actually more than 20 years, we were all very, very close. And I would sit and listen to how they spoke about the natural world. And so much it was the opposite to how I grew up. It was very, very different. You know, just a whole different mindset, whole different consciousness, whole different spirituality, really, if you will, about the planet. And I don't know how many times I would catch my friend Dwayne, whose Native American name is Mukwode, which means bear heart, because he is. He's one of the two guys that I walked from the Upper Peninsula to Chicago and back with way back in 1996. And I would catch him just kind of standing in the woods. Like, what are you doing? Listening. What are you listening to? Well, if you'd be quiet, you might hear it too. And to stand in the forest, and by the way, the word forest, do you ever think about it? Forest, F-O-R-E-S-T, is for rest. You go there to rest. That's the whole idea. And he would just stand there and listen. And when I would ask him later, well, what exactly did you hear? He'd say, got to figure it out yourself. That was one of the big prominent lessons about so much of the time I spent with those folks, was figuring it out yourself. We live in a day and age where a life coach is supposed to tell you what your problems are. And the truth is that the best way to improve your life is to figure it out yourself. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have, you know, kind of bumpers on each side to help you guide your way. There may be people and books and projects and things that help that. But to thine own self be true, you have to figure this stuff out yourself. That's what growth is all about. To me, that's what evolution's all about. So that particular Earth Matters with BK talking about the trees, I remember writing that and thinking of what a concept, because all we see for the most part are the trees above the ground, right? But we don't understand the network underneath. And that's so much like humanity. All we see is what's going on at the surface for the most part. We don't see the interconnectedness that we all have underneath that is constantly going on, that we're all connected to each other and to this incredible biosphere that we are so lucky to inhabit. There is no other place to go. As Carl Sagan said, this is where we will make our last stand, or not. April is also Organ Donation Awareness Month, something very, very near and dear to my heart. I've written about this in both of my books. I think I wrote about it in Phenomenon, and I also wrote about it in Every Moment Matters, that I donated a kidney to my daughter when she was 13 years old. The whole history of how we got to that point is getting further and further in the rearview mirror. But she was born with kidney reflux, which was a condition that did not reverse itself. Hopefully it was supposed to. It didn't happen. They removed her right kidney when she was 5. And they said, you know, by the time she's 6, 7 for sure, she'd need a transplant and dialysis and all this stuff. And that'll scare the shit out of any parent. And we had a very difficult time back then with all that. But we also saw a Chinese herbalist during that time, an incredible man named Dr. Lau, who I, beyond a shadow of a doubt, helped save her immune system over time with Eastern medicine that we combined with Western medicine. So we did both. Sometimes, you know, we get a little stuck in this or that thing in life. Sometimes it's important to consider this and that. That's not one way or the other. I think that's the one thing that really frosts my cookies when it comes to politics, especially, is you're either a Republican or Democrat. That's it. That's the extent of my experience of being alive on Earth, being boiled down to a political, you know, title. Come on. So we used East and West, and she went all the way to the age of 13 before she needed this transplant. And I was the perfect donor, perfect match, so honored, humbled. One of the reasons I showed up on the planet to be able to do that. And that lasted until 2018, that kidney. She went through some difficulties, had to go on dialysis for 16 months, which is just brutal. So if any of you listening are on dialysis, have gone through it, know people in it, it's hell. It's a rough go. And my daughter is built like a swan, but as tough as a linebacker. And to watch her go through this dialysis process, first at a dialysis center where she would walk there 3 days a week and do the thing, and then have the opportunity and option to do it at home, which means she was hooked up for about, I don't know, 14 hours a night, overnight till the next morning, and do this on her own. Incredible to watch for all the wrong reasons, but still admirable and incredible. And it's not my place to say exactly how the second transplant came around. That's really her story, but it's one of benevolence and providence and unbelievable coincidence that made that possible. She got her third kidney, I believe it was in 2020. A lot of stuff around the pandemic was going on and getting her in and out of the hospital. So anyway, it was a long haul for our family and especially for her. And I don't know how to accurately convey to you the importance of being an organ donor. I mean, when I was on WGN in Chicago especially, but everywhere I've gone on radio, I always did PSAs and I would talk about an organ donation. Doubt I would do it unless it had been part of my family, part of my daughter's journey. And I think that's one of the big challenges with getting people to do anything outside of themselves is because it's not their problem. If you go to the thought and concept of climate change and global warming, well, if it hasn't affected me, it must not be real. And yet on the other side of the planet, it's the hottest it's ever been in Australia, and people are losing their entire farms because of the fires. So if we're not directly connected to something, it's somebody else's problem. And unless kidney failure, heart failure, liver problems, one of a myriad of things that organ donation can help is not part of your existence, it's just somebody else's problem. Unfortunately, anytime, I mean, there are people who are perfectly healthy and they may get an illness and their kidneys shut down. Next thing you know, they're waiting in line for a transplant. There is nobody that's exempt from any of that. So I think that's the first big stumbling block. Well, that's never happened to me. Why should I care? Well, because it can happen, or to somebody that you care about. And so to be an organ donor, to me, is the highest calling. Now, it's one thing to sign your driver's license. I don't know if you actually do that physically anymore, but you can digitally get that done on your driver's license. You want to be an organ donor in the case of your death. Well, your death's coming anyway. Sorry to break it to you. It might be today. It might be 20 years from now. It might be 50 years from now, but it's going to happen at some point. And if your parts are still workable, why not give them to someone who needs them? To me, that's just like the most common sense thing in the world. But again, unless it's your need, it's not a need. Unless it's in your hip pocket, it's not even in a pocket. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think, as I just said, you know, we all come in right on time. We know the date, the time, how much we weighed, who the doctor was, our parents, whatever, the hospital. But none of us have that piece of paper that says when you're leaving. Go ahead, look for it. I'll wait. Oh, there isn't any. So because of that, I don't think we like to face our own mortality very much. And I can tell you after two, quote, near-life, near-death experiences, it's going to happen. And, you know, I got electrocuted when I was 19, and they had to bring me back, and I was cut out of a car in an accident at 27. They had to bring me back. It can happen in an instant, and you have no say. Or it could be a lingering thing, and you may have some say. My point is that at some point, the expiration date gets called in, and out you go. And it's the highest calling to do something about that, to leave something, in my opinion, behind that can help somebody you don't even know, a stranger, like what happened to my daughter, who's now best friends with the donor for her, this third kidney she's had. So to face our own mortality is a challenge. And when you sign your name on that card, license, your driver's license, or put it in digitally, or however you do it, wherever state you live, you're admitting the fact that at some point you're going to die, and then you're going to have to give somebody your body parts. Yeah, and next question. So here's a couple stats that from 2023 that actually are good news. For the first time ever in the history of organ donation, over 25,000 kidney transplants happened for the first time. That is a huge number. Last year, they also set all-time records for liver, heart, and lung transplants. Exceeded 42,800 total transplants. And finally, this is the one that really, because my daughter's in this category to some degree, actually her donor is, a total of 6,466 people became living organ donors in 2023, slightly lower than 2022, but still, it is a trend that is on the upswing and starting to stabilize. So while most living donors provide a kidney for transplant, an increasing number of people donate a segment of their liver. The liver regenerates. It's a pretty incredible thing. You can actually give a segment of your liver, a piece of your liver, give them the liver, and yours will regenerate. You will have no effect. And people have asked me over the years, you know, did I feel any effects of giving up my kidney? Mine was done laparoscopically. I went into UW-Madison Hospital, and they punched a bunch of holes in me. And I know it sounds graphic, but that's the way you do it. And they cut a little envelope slit under my belly button, a little bit lower than that. I can't wear those low-slung banana hammocks anymore because it's just kind of ruined my whole physique. But they did that, and out comes the kidney, and they put it in my daughter. And next thing you know, Jed's a millionaire. And I got to tell you what, when I woke up after that surgery, and the nurse, you know, brought me back, and I said, "How's my girl?" And the nurse said, "She's peeing like she was born with that kidney herself." And it's never stopped, except for that space of time in 2018 to 2020. So when you can do that, I don't care if you're someone's father or mother, sister, brother, but if you're a stranger and you do that, that is the highest calling. So those people who are the angel donors out there and doing that, that's an incredible thing. And so to think there may be somebody that you read about in the paper or hear about on the news that needs a body part, a kidney, or some help with their liver, it's astonishing what happens on both ends when that takes place. Obviously, the person who gets the healthy organ changes immensely. My daughter said it was like being kickstarted again, like she was born again at the age of 13. She's never really stopped being that person. It was just this surge of life in her. So just keep in mind, when you know, life is short, folks. There's no guarantee we're going to be here tomorrow. Please consider doing something that is much bigger than you. And even though the life you might not save is your own, that's the whole point. That's the whole point. To all of that, I had to roll back to a clip that I found earlier today about organ donation and my conversation with George Lopez back when I was on Oprah Radio in 09 or 10, one of those 2 years, I don't recall exactly, who had received a kidney from his wife at the time. And it was an interesting conversation. I don't know, because I haven't listened to the whole clip now, if it's in there, but if it isn't, they eventually divorced after 17 years and she didn't want the kidney back. So at least that was a pretty good deal. So in some ways, I think when those things take place, you know, there's a lot of reasons we're in people's lives for reasons and seasons, right? And sometimes it's something specific and sometimes it's much broader, but this conversation, the bits and pieces I listened to, I thought was worth including in here. So it's a little bit of a throwback on a Saturday with George Lopez. You all know him from television and stand-up. He had his own TV show for a while. Pretty funny guy. Talking about all that. And on the other side of that, I'll come back and finish this up.
You're listening to Oprah Radio.
Here's a guy that proves once and for all that intelligent design and evolution can actually coexist.
Back at it on Oprah Radio, XM 156 and Sirius 195. This is John St. Augustine sitting in, and I'm really excited today on a lot of reasons. Number one is that every time I get a chance to sit down with somebody who makes people laugh, especially during very difficult times, they have my attention, number one. And number two, when I get to sit with somebody who has come from a very difficult background and still finds things to laugh about, he really has my attention. And finally, we'll get to this in a little bit, anybody who has received another body part from someone else and has gone on to really change their life and change lives of other people, they really have my attention. George Lopez, you'd have to be born on some other planet and not living on this one for the last 30 years to know that he is one of the most prominent Mexican-Americans in the Latino community who has come out and made every race laugh, at themselves mostly, and he joins me this morning. How you doing?
That's a wonderful introduction. Yeah, I'm going
to
keep that
took
and
10
just
minutes
play
to do
it.
That.
Even when I walk into a department store, I'm going to have play that over the...
Anything else you'd like me to say?
Yeah, I think you covered it. Right. Also, 10 handicap golfer.
You know, I was getting to that. It's down here. But listen, you know, you've been making people laugh for a long time, but it wasn't always that way for you. You grew up at a very difficult time, and I was wondering, even though I was watching the Oprah show, what is the spark that keeps you still laughing, even though we are in difficult times, you've been through difficult times? How do you find the things that we should be laughing at that we don't and make us, you know, kind of look at that a little bit?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, we had so little growing up, and it just was funny to me to see my grandmother mop with a broom that wasn't a mop. Mm. You know, those kind of things. I've always kind of had a vision for her and the way she sounded, or telling me that I couldn't do things, and instead of making myself having to make me angry, it made me laugh.
Like that whole nightlight thing.
Yes, the whole nightlight. So you know, like I would be reading a book and she would turn the light off on me, and I'm like, I'm reading, and then she would say, "Also, now you read." So it just was just funny to me. And what's really interesting is before my show and before I had some success, in the clubs, people would say, "Well, he's kind of like this. I don't really kind of get it."
Who did they compare you to in the early days?
You know, I'm not sure that there was a comparison. One of the things that I thought was the best comparison was that I didn't get compared to Paul Rodriguez, because they would say, like, "Well, he's not like Paul Rodriguez." I wanted to be my own person, even though I didn't really know what that person was going to be like. Mm-hmm. I always had to have my own thoughts be my own. And if you look at the stand-up, they're not really jokes as much as they are a string of recollections. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was always really introverted. My wife is an extrovert, and she'll say, "Why are you so quiet?" And it's really because I'm processing information. Mm-hmm. It's like, excuse me, you know, somebody puts on their computer, "Do not touch,"
right?
Like a stick pad.
Leave me be.
Leave me. So on me, I process information, and now it's just funny to me, and it's universal. And in becoming, you know, the show and the stand-up, now the best reward is that when people say, "I didn't get it," now everybody gets it, like you said. I mean, there's some people that came to see me at Radio City Music Hall in New York that were Israeli. They're Indian. They're you know, they're from the Middle East, and they all get it, because poor
is poor.
Is poor.
It don't matter where you're living. You got dirt in your pockets. It doesn't matter where you're at.
So, you know, we managed to still find. I mean, it's just things, you know, like I saw a guy washing a car that looked like it wouldn't even start, but that guy was washing that thing like it was a Rolls. I mean, just I love that in your mind, how your imagination makes you believe that things are better than they are.
But could you have ever imagined growing up the way that you did, and the route that you've taken to get where you're at, that you'd be this, you know, you have this ability to take things that are obvious and absurd and make them more obvious and absurd, is which we laugh at. You become a spokesperson, obviously, for being more positive in life. I mean, that's like this whole offshoot of the work that you do. Could you have ever thought of that?
No. You know, I didn't, you know, it's funny because when you even dream about making it in whatever business, I didn't dream beyond doing The Tonight Show. Back then, everybody wanted to do The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Sure.
So after I did The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson with 91, I sat around going, okay, now
what?
What am I going to do? I'm not really a good actor. I haven't really acted, and I have no agent. I just continue to do stand-up. And when I saw other guys, the difficult part for me was to see other guys get shows and get plucked from the clubs, and for me to still be there. And I at some point in life, as it works, the less you worry about other people, the better off you're going to be. Mm-hmm. So inherently being Latino, we're always worried about what other people are doing. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was like, "Go tell them that their clothes have been on the line for 3 days. Tell them to take them off." I can go over and tell them to take their clothes off the line.
It's really funny, but the persistence gene that you have to, or the persistence muscle that you have to learn how to flex and to keep strong when you're going in, especially in the media and in the entertainment business. I mean, now that you're quote unquote on top, do you find that you still have to keep that part of yourself alive no matter what?
Well, I think you do, because you want to continue to do better things. 4 years ago in April, I would read those Star and the Enquirer and Us, and they're fantastic magazines. But being in the business, it consumed a lot of my time, and I knew I had useless information in my head. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I don't think I can be the best that I can be with useless information in my head. Mm-hmm. So I made a decision that I wasn't going to read those magazines. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to look on the internet about what people thought of me. I wasn't going to Google myself to see how many hits. And I was just going to be honest about my own work and let that speak for itself. Very old days, like 50s, where where you had to go to the theater to hear about somebody. You know, you had to read the paper. So I went back and I thought, you know, I'm going to do it the way they used to do it. If I hear about it, then it must be important.
So you went back to fundamentals.
I went back to the fundamentals. And it's worked well for me.
Yeah, it really
has worked well for me.
Well, it was interesting to me when I watch your show on TV, it seems to be like we've had the Cosby Show and we've had All in the Family. We've had all these things. And the one thread that I've seen through all of them is no matter what color you are, where you come from, what language you speak, we all have issues to deal with. So you're bringing to light things that I can relate to, no matter how many kids I have or how old they are. When you're talking to your daughter on TV, I'm like, that's what I said to my daughter last night. So it's the brilliant writing, but it's the delivery. Do you think that's your background that allows you to deliver it with that kind of...
When we were deciding to do the show, we didn't know what kind of show it was going to have, what the temperament or the tone was going to be. So as I started to talk, remember, I'm like an introvert, so we sat there for... about a month, and I started to tell stories about growing up. And it was good for me because I was touching on things that I hadn't thought about in a long time. A lot of them were very painful. You know, I started crying in the room, and those guys were, then they have like an assistant typing, and the two guys I was working with, they'd look over at me and go, is this dude crying? And I'm like, yeah, it was, you know, really painful. And they're like, if you want to stop, I'm like, no. And this was in an office in Warner Brothers. So we found the bottom. And then we knew the top was going to be laughter and good stories. A lot of those stories in the show are very true. You know, I didn't know my father, and you know, my daughter was growing up, and my mother, you know, in the show treated me with disrespect, and she was like a manhunter. You know, and
I was watching one the other night where you stuff the bra. In the pants?
Yes. That was Jerry Springer's.
His walk-out. I saw that.
Yeah. He, I didn't want them to be together, so I planted a bra in his jacket.
Right, it wasn't just any bra. It was a bra.
Huge, massive, massive bra. Yes. And you know, that kind of stuff. I did sabotage by the times my mom were around. But the show has a real a second life, a bigger life in syndication. Everybody loves it. And when I was a little kid and I wanted to dream, I never dreamed in brown. I always dreamt in black and white. So and now little kids and all kids come over and say, hey, we really love your show. And they're all multicultural and they're different colors and they're little girls and boys. And for me, because I had so little and I had so little respect, that when that happens, it really makes you feel good about what
you've
done.
It's important to you, isn't it?
It really is.
But I can tell you, I mean, I've had everybody sit in front of me. And the eyes are the window to the soul, as they say. And as you're talking... this is really important. It's almost an offshoot of being a funny guy and a comedian and an actor. It's more of an ambassador, isn't it?
It's become an ambassador from somebody who wasn't very comfortable in my own skin or the color of the skin. And then to do all of that and to know that, you know, my stand-up is very adult. And it's
really?
I even say, listen, don't bring the kids. But then Nickelodeon is that, and then some movies that I've done, and then you know in November I'll have my own talk show.
Your own talk show on TBS coming up. And what do you expect? I mean, this will be a little time before people hear. What do you want to take? What direction with
you
that
know,
show?
I was fortunate enough in 1989 to be on Arsenio Hall when Arsenio Hall first started, and I was there all 5 years that he was on. I did I think 16 appearances, and it really the city that I had my most success in was in Chicago back then.
Really?
I used to work at the Funny Firm.
Oh, sure.
312 West Grand. That's a Quiznos, I believe. And what I saw was I saw an audience that was excited. I saw a diverse music. I saw an inclusive atmosphere. And I saw somebody who was present. And I think a little bit now in late night, there seems to be a disconnect from being present. And I want to bring that back, that energy back, that diversity
back. The fundamentals.
And the
You're back to the same
to
thing,
the
aren't you?
Of just doing a good show.
George Lopez joining me this morning on Oprah Radio. John St. Augustine sitting in at XM 156 and Sirius 195. Switching gears a little bit, one of the reasons, as I mentioned before, I was excited to have you in is that we have something in common, you and I. Not much, but something in common. I'm not as funny, and I'm a little bit taller, but that's where it ends. My daughter was born with a kidney defect. Her the ureters didn't insert in the bladder all the way. And so when she was 5 years old, they took her right kidney out, and they said she'd need a transplant within a couple of years. So we made it 8 years. And then it turned out, against all the odds, my father and grandfather both died of polycystic kidney disease. I was the perfect donor. I was the perfect match at 13. So we knew for a long time since she was born this was going to have to happen. So we did the transplant in 2002, and she became a new person. You know, she was like the first time in her life at 13 that she was healthy and what that feels like as a parent. And 5 years ago, you find out that you have challenges with your kidney, And you, I mean, you're not 13, obviously. Well, maybe 16 at that time. But, you know, I mean, you're a grown man finding this out. How was that?
Do you know what the problem that I had is my ureters were narrow and didn't drain completely correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. So it backed urine
but
up.
But your whole life.
Kidneys. My whole life.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I didn't, we didn't go to the doctor when we felt bad. We just kind of let it go.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had some issues and I had moderate borderline hypertension at 18. I was in probably the best shape I've ever been.
Because people don't know kidneys are the thing that regulates blood pressure. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they're not working, it ain't working.
Yes. Yeah, so if, you know, if your car engine light was on, most people would
tape
get it
over
fixed.
It. No, you put tape over it.
We put a picture of a loved one over it and you can't see that you're running oil 12,000 miles.
That's right.
And
that's
you
right.
can't wonder why your car. So, so I advocate early prevention and early detection. If anything I do is to, if I wet the bed when I was a kid and there was a problem because I couldn't drain correctly. And then at night it, when I was relaxed, so my grandmother, instead of, you know, making an example out of me and putting my sheet on the
flag,
air.
Yeah, right.
And she'd got, French toast. It looks like French toast. So if she would have taken me to the doctor, this is the really important thing. If she had taken me to the doctor, I would have saved both kidneys. I'd had stents put in and I would save kidneys. And now when we did a show about the exact same thing that happened to me, we got a couple of emails. One was from a father who son went to bed and he used to yell at him and he took him to go get checked and he had something wrong and they found something. Instead of yelling at him, they actually found a condition.
But I don't know if it's against all odds, but interestingly enough, your wife turns out to be the person. I mean, you really owe her now big time for the rest of your life. But I mean, how did that happen? How did you find out that she was the match? And what did that feel like when you realized this person you married all these years later is the one's going to save your life?
When I first found out that I had advanced kidney disease, the guy called it, and that both my kidneys were running at 55%, like 98. Mm-hmm. She says, I'll give you one of mine. She's sitting like at the end of the desk and I'll give you one of mine. I'm like, please, Ann, I'm really sick. Yeah. I'll give you one of mine. She was the only person tested.
Really?
And it's a battery of tests,
I know. It's a thing.
And I've never been fortunate in my life. I was always an example of don't do this and don't, you don't want to be like him. But in everything that's happened to me in my life, meeting her, and although I did kind of fight it because I didn't see healthy relationships, so I made it difficult on her, and she hung in there. But getting her to love me the way she did and love me enough to donate part of her body so that I can continue my life is without question the greatest gift that I could ever have been given. Although I've given her many gifts of jewelry.
I was gonna say, substantial
and
value.
And we haven't even reached the top, apparently. We haven't even scratched the surface. This Christmas, I went crazy. I said, I'm going to throw it all out. I'm going to give her this and that, and a necklace and pearls. And she's like, this is very lovely. Not, no, please, George, stop. It's enough. She just says, very lovely. Yeah. She's at the Oprah store across the street. Then it's not even open. They opened it for her.
I'm sure they did. George Lopez joining me on Oprah Radio. Last few minutes we have together. I'm fascinated by your fascination and your honesty. You know, a lot of people talk about their lives, but you seem to have the ability or the need to really be frank about who you are, where you've been, what your life is like. And when other people connect with that, even though we're laughing with you, we're looking at ourselves. And is that part of the deal we don't know about, or you didn't intend,
it? Well, it's opposite of what I was. I was always, I always falsified the truth. I would always lie because things were so bad that I would say, what did you guys do this weekend? My grandfather wouldn't let me out. And I said, I went to my cousin's house and we went swimming and had a barbecue. All lies.
All to cover up
the fact that I had nothing going on. Yeah. And I made up friends and made up situations and quit on everything. Quit on friends and quit at baseball and just quit. I was a quitter and I lied. Hmm. A liar and a quitter. And through stand-up and through golf, interestingly enough, golf will expose every weakness that you have, and it doesn't care whether you're rich or poor. Mm-hmm. And I would hit the ball sideways, and I'd quit. And just voices in my head, you know, like my coach saying, you know, go ahead and quit because that's what you are. And I just stayed with it. And even in comedy early on, I quit, and I couldn't have everybody be right. I had to prove to myself that I could do something and not quit.
Was there an epiphany? Was there a time you sat and said, you know what, this is it. I'm not lying anymore. this is the bottom line. I'm moving up. Was there an incident?
Yes. I'd lost my job, and I was living on my friend's couch in Pacoima, California in 1984.
I know. He just called in, by the way. You owe him $6. So.
It wasn't a very comfortable couch. And I remember waking up on my birthday in 1984 thinking, you know, I have nothing going on in my life. Even my grandparents had taken the key to the house from me.
These are the people that raised you.
Yeah, they said, we need the key back because you don't live here
anymore.
Wow. And I laid there, and I thought, I got to do something for me, and I got to do something that I enjoy doing because I'm not happy with the way that my life is turning out. And at that point, April 23rd, 1984, I decided that I was going to stick with this, and I've stuck with golf the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been successful in it, and also I've been I've been more generous in success than I was than on the way up. Mm-hmm. I think in success I found generosity and a caring for other people that I didn't have when I was doing stand-up.
So the concept of transformation, going from who you used to be to
yes.
who you are now, is like you're on act two. Is there an act three for George Lopez?
Act
three?
There's an act three. Act three is when the show starts. We're going to make that inclusive and help a lot of people and hopefully regenerate I don't want to say hope. That one's been used.
No, regenerate, that's good. Hope is good.
Regenerate
is good.
Energy and regenerate enjoyment of the things that have happened in the past. That just because they happened in the past don't mean that they're relevant today. And mm-hmm. also in the future, you know, the music that I love so much and those bands. I just had Chicago play at my kidney
is
dinner.
Is that right?
And they were fantastic.
Fantastic, yeah.
And I love Chicago. So you see those guys and I go, you know, I'm going to put Chicago on my show and we're going to get relevant actors and actresses.
Excellent.
And we're going to have comedy and help comedians and help yeah. people and from that, you know, help families at night and do things at night that nobody's really has done before, which includes interaction and helping people.
So what's the big aha for you over the years? If you look back on your life and you see this path that you've traveled on, that all these people have come in and out of, the way that you grew up, the circumstances you had to overcome, the golf game that's improved tremendously yep. over the years. What's the big aha for you?
The big aha is that I'm more valuable than I've ever given myself credit for. I always disvalued myself, and I did it to myself. So the big aha is, you know, I really do have value, and I really can be somebody.
There's about 6 billion other people on the planet that need to get that message, too.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where they're at. George
and,
Lopez.
And humanity. I mean, it's really about, you know, you and I just met. We got along great. And it's really about humanity.
Well, I'm faking it.
Yeah. I'll listen to the playback.
Yeah, that's right. It's all good. Really nice to meet you.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
No problem. George Lopez on Oprah Radio, John St. Augustine, XM 156, Sirius 195. We'll be back with more after this.
I was walking down the street one day.
So that's, you know, it's interesting to listen to myself from years ago. I think my voice is continually dropping an octave ability because I think I've been talking so much for so long, my vocal cords have gotten stretched out. Often when I listen to cassette tapes of shows that I did in the 90s, I mean, I don't think I'm out of puberty yet. It's astounding. And I was in my 30s when I started doing that. So it's interesting to hear myself. And of course, George Lopez is great. He's back on the air. Lopez versus Lopez, I think is the name of the show. And while I'm not huge into sitcoms, it's nice to see him doing well and staying healthy. I'm going to wrap this up. I actually had a couple other songs lined up in my head to do this, but I have to go back to that thing with the trees. And I had to go back to that thought that, you know, the guy in Germany said they're all connected. And I think of us as the same way. Like it or not, believe it or not, don't care or not, we're all connected. It's the bottom line. And this song written by Michael Martin Murphy called Boy from the Country about St. Francis of Assisi. And last year, on what would have been John Denver's 80th birthday, I got a hold of Murph. I asked for his permission to use the song. He said, of course. He was on the show, if you heard that. And I was able to, through the magic of technology, use part of Murph's version, the original version that he did of the song, Boy from the Country, and then mash up with John Denver's version, which was a huge hit for him, especially what was on that Double Live album, An Evening with John Denver, back in 1975. And Murph talks about the fact that had John not recorded that song at that time, he'd have starved to death as a songwriter. And because he was able to pay his bills, he then wrote something called Wildfire, which did great as well. So on the way out the door, we'll let JD and Michael Martin Murphy take care of business. Until next time, be well, safe travels, and please consider being an organ donor, won't you? Keep the faith.
This is one of the first songs I wrote. It was recorded by John Denver when I was just working as a songwriter. This is the first time I ever got a check for writing a song. So I owe it all to him. He's the one that got me started. We became friends, and I miss him. Nobody else like him. Because he called, far is better. Because he called, the earth is mother. They drove him out into the rain, and some people even said that the boy from the country was insane. Because he spoke with fish in the creek, he tried to tell us that the animals can speak. And who knows, maybe they do. Maybe they do. Hey, how do you know they don't? Just because they've never spoken to you. Boy from the country left his home and he was young. Boy from the country, he loves the sun as he does. He tried to tell us. We should love the land. We just turned our heads and laughed. You see, we did not understand. Sometimes I think a boy from the country is the only one who sees. 'Cause a boy from the country doesn't want to see the forest for the trees. Boy from the country left his home when he was young. Boy from the country, he loved the sun. Ooh, do, 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 do. Oh, oh, oh. Mm-hmm. Oh, lady.